March is almost over. April's going to be such a great month.
What if
doesn't
I told
matter
you,
now.
What if I told you that the primary election was this month?
Yeah, that's hard to believe. It's still not even, they certified the election results on Friday, but they have not yet declared the election over yet.
The election is technically still happening.
What does that mean? Is it delayed because of coronavirus?
No,
this is the schedule. This was, yeah, they released the schedule at the very beginning.
Declare it over on the 31st and then transmit all of the votes to the California Secretary of State's office.
Wow.
It took almost you did not realize that that was going to be the last normal week that you ever had.
And even that week was not normal. It was very
weird. No, it
was
in no way normal. It was not normal. Well, April will be totally normal, yeah. So it'll be fine.
This is LA Podcast. I'm Hayes Davenport, and I'm here with Scott Frazier and Alyssa Walker. The music... You, if you've heard that before, if it's giving you PTSD, it's because that is, I think the new like hold music or recess music for the video feed of the LA City Council meeting.
Right.
Very dramatic, very intense. It sets a nice tone for the proceedings. There was a big City Council meeting this week via Zoom, where a lot of stuff happened that we will talk about in detail. But first, I thought we could just talk about our own personal experiences, in particular with the coronavirus outbreak. Alyssa, you posted this week that your mom, after a couple weeks of feeling sick, was diagnosed positive with coronavirus in Colorado. How's she feeling?
She's doing great. She feels good now. I'm glad I didn't know that it was it until she was feeling a little bit better, or else I would have been a lot more worried at the time. So maybe it's a good thing it took her so long to get tested. But she, yeah, I mean, I think she did something really smart. I don't know if I talked about this last time, but I think I talked about her trying to get tested. But she, as soon as she had symptoms, she isolated herself from my dad to make sure that he did not get it.
Right.
Even though nobody told her to do so. And that doesn't seem to be something that they're even pushing in a lot of places right now. So
and she
just say,
like,
stay home.
She was like repeatedly trying to get tested and kept being told that she didn't meet the criteria.
Right.
To be tested.
She reached out to her county health department. And again, this is, we can talk about LA's testing changes this week, which I think are really good for what the city is doing and the county. But yeah, she called her county public health because they have, I think, the same thing in a lot of places where they just say, if you feel fine, we're probably not going to test you, but you can call anyway and just let us know so they can track symptoms. They said she should go get tested because of they were worried about compromised immunity for my dad and that she was technically old enough. But I guess, like, if you're just a year shy of their requirements, you roll up to the testing center and they say, oh, no, that not today. Or, you know, we're not testing people your age today or something. So she did wait and she went back again and the test was positive. And meanwhile, a lot of her friends have it in this very small town. And I think what's really concerning is we're hearing a lot about the big cities, what's happening in New York, what's happening in maybe New Orleans. But the biggest problems are going to be a place like where they live that has a very small hospital and no ICU beds. So what they're doing there, if someone gets really sick, they have to put you onto a helicopter and fly you to another hospital. And that's not going to work for certain aspects of this disease, as far as I'm seeing, you know, where people very quickly deteriorate and need oxygen and respirators or ventilators. So it's going to be a really scary and probably a lot longer battle in a lot of these places because the disease got there very fast, or the virus got there very fast. The disease is probably going to be worse in a lot of these places because some people are older and, you know, communities that are people who go to retire. So this is going to be a long battle, I think, for a lot of these rural communities.
Well, I'm so glad that she is on the other side of it. And, like, I know you had sort of assumed that she did have it.
Yeah, I think that's what that you have to, I think, I don't even think anybody told her that, but she just operated that way. And that's how we all should be operating. So
yeah.
I think that was super smart mm-hmm. on her behalf. And meanwhile, like, this town has some of the high, you know, you can't get any help because everybody is older and everybody is supposed to be inside. So they have a very small group of somewhat younger people who are helping out. But then what happens when those people start to get sick? It's just...
Yeah. And you bring up a really good point about like being in a small town and having a, you know, like either not enough hospital beds or not the appropriate equipment, specifically the ventilators that all of the hospitals across the nation are trying to get a hold of right now so that they can help out people who are in the most critical cases. That's where like the news over the past couple of days of how dire the situation is in a lot of states and really like the criminal conduct of the federal administration becomes so concerning when you're talking about like Colorado, where the federal administration gave them something, medical supplies that I think that their public health officials in Colorado were saying would be enough to last a single day.
Right.
And then, you know, other states are also not receiving, I mean, including California, we're not receiving anywhere near the number of medical supplies and products that we've requested. But it's a very frightening situation because you do end up in a situation where you can be isolated very far from like the nearest facility that could help you in that situation.
Or just like groceries, like we think about grocery delivery, like no problem, it might come a few days later, but you could get probably someone to pick something up for you.
Right.
Not in a place like that. They have grocery stores don't deliver. I mean, it's just not something they do.
So, I mean, that's a question that I have now in terms of next steps, not to put any pressure on your mom, should just relax. But once you, you know, in the situation you're talking about where she lives in a community where it's very difficult for people to help each other, and there are a lot of people that are kind of isolated and just caring for themselves, at what point do we find out, A, if it's safe, and B, like if it's possible for people to get tested for antibodies, to get a serology test, I think it's called, where they can now actually go out and
be afraid.
Right.
Like,
well,
yeah.
Funny you ask that, because the ski town over, Telluride in Colorado, is doing that. They don't have any cases right now. And there's like a couple tech people who have roots there in some way, and they're paying for everyone in the town to get the blood test, which will show the antibodies, that what you're talking about. So it'll show if you had it and recovered or if you haven't had it, and they will actually be able to test everyone in the town. And then that's how you start to reopen a town. And then I guess you put up some barriers. There's only really one way into this town. So you maybe check everybody before they come in and out of this checkpoint, or you wear a wristband or something. I don't know. I mean, I think that's kind of what you have to do. And that's how you start to see certain places reopen.
And we think everything points to the fact that like once you have had it, it is. I heard stuff for a while about like second infections, but I think that was misinformation on some. It was people that hadn't quite gotten over it.
Yeah, I think they found those were testing errors, and the blood test is very accurate, apparently, that these people have developed. So I think we will start to see that down the road. But again, how do you start? Then you start to, this whole other question of isolating people, you know, from each other, or, you know, the checkpoints or something, where you try to make sure that people are not coming into your study group without introducing something.
Right. Scott, how are you? I saw you released your quarantine schedule today, which had you enjoying some wine at 1 p.m., which you budgeted. I noticed you budgeted an hour for that and 5 hours for this podcast recording.
There are some gaps in there. I was like, I don't know. What am I going to do after this? Take another nap? Second nap? I don't know. I do know that my nightly routine of playing solitaire and watching Pride and Prejudice has been treating me pretty well. So...
Of all the games, why solitaire? Come on, you could at least pick something a little more.
Like what?
Like just doesn't underline the dire situation.
I'm open to suggestions.
Go fish? I don't know.
Yeah. You live with someone. People will assume that you're alone.
I'm doing okay. You know, this past week I've gotten into a routine of going for a run every day since I started feeling better, going up some of the stairs in my neighborhood in Silver Lake. There have been people out, but as far as I can tell, just, you know, anecdotally, like people are doing a good job of distancing. I have seen a huge increase in the number of people that I see wearing masks out and about. I would say pretty much everybody that I see outside now is doing that. And in general, I think a lot of my initial anxiety about this being such a large and frightening and destabilizing sort of event is starting to subside, which is good because, I mean, having to just like exist with that gnawing sort of anxiety every single day, which I know like a lot of friends of mine are still going through. It's just a very hard place to be in. So it's hard, especially being like tapped into the like, you know, the one thing that you still have access to is the social media endless stream of news.
Yeah.
So I think it is important to, whenever possible, sort of detach from that. But this week has been better than last week by far.
What you're saying about going for runs and stuff and people being out on the sidewalk, I do want to talk about a piece that Alyssa published this week that has been resonating with me, and I think a lot of people, for Curbed. But first, I thought we could just like sort of check in on where the outbreak is at in Los Angeles. It felt like, it might be just a slow boil element of it, but it felt like there was no point this week where you were thinking, wow, it's getting really serious. And yet, I was looking back, last time we recorded, there had been 4 total deaths of coronavirus in LA County. And as of now, Sunday afternoon, they haven't released the Sunday numbers yet, but from Saturday to Saturday, it went from 4 to 32, which means that the number of deaths did double just about every 2 days, which is a very significant multiplier. The biggest jump was, I think, 9 deaths in one day, which is pretty dramatic. And that actually does reflect what happened at the beginning of Italy's outbreak. And then it just rose and rose. It kept increasing by like that sort of exponential rate for a while. I think for us, a reason that people are somewhat more optimistic is the fact that in places like Italy and New York, when they were seeing people start to die of this disease, they had not yet at that point and put shelter in place in, like, they hadn't implemented those policies yet. And we have now, as of today, Sunday, been under shelter, and we've been at least under social distancing for about 2 weeks, which we're hoping that will keep these numbers low instead of like seeing them grow and grow and grow over the next week. This week feels like a pretty important test over whether these measures are working and what kind of outbreak we're going to see in LA, right?
Absolutely. I feel like, well, I mean, we've been talking about this a lot throughout the week. I feel very optimistic about not only what California did to respond to this in terms of beginning to shut down social spaces and things like that, but the timing, which we know is so important. Like, the difference between doing something like shelter in place, you know, one like on a Monday or a Thursday can have an enormous impact on what your outbreak is going to look like. And like you're saying, Hayes, like we have had shelter in place for quite a while now. So even as we start to see the number of cases and hospitalizations rise, which again, we expect will continue at least for the next few weeks, then we have the ability, or at least the hope, that it will not grow out of control exponentially. And I think one of the big things that's been pointed out in the reporting that I've read is that things like sheltering in place or the more serious lockdowns that have happened in Europe and Asia take 12 to 14 days to be fully impactful. So again, if you are already in this phase where that growth is happening unchecked, doing the shelter in place or the lockdown too late, the disease is going to wind its way through the population anyway. Since we've been in this shelter in place state for quite a bit here, we're still not at 12 days, I don't think, but I think we're approaching that pretty quickly. That actually was the 16th, yeah, the night of the 16th that they put out. Mm-hmm. So today is like the 12th day right now.
Then, that was like the full shelter in place. Merrick Garcetti, who I do want, like, as we have criticized him for all kinds of stuff on this show, in terms of putting the protections in place and shutting the city down early, I think he and London Breed are the two, mayor of San Francisco, are the two people in this country, with the exception, I mean, I think in Washington, they imposed some great measures as well, but that as a result of having a very early impact from the disease there. Garcetti and Breed have both just done an excellent job. The consequences of their decisions are so wide-ranging. They saved so many lives with what they did, which at the time a lot of people criticized them for.
Yeah.
And we owe Garcetti just like a huge debt for being a leader on this issue. Whereas, I mean, we've been texting about it this week. It is kind of bizarre. I mean, I understand why people are in New York, where the crisis is so traumatic and so horrible, are looking for leadership. But I see so much celebration of not so much de Blasio, but Governor Cuomo. And they were later than
late. Yeah.
Yeah.
They went back and forth for like a week when we had already solidified most of our actions.
And things like parks are still open. In
yeah, they still have their playgrounds open in New York, which I am just like, I can't, that's the one thing that just like fills me with dread, that just knowing now that we have not only, and we'll talk about this, a 17-year-old that died here in Los Angeles County, but a baby died, an infant in Chicago. So people don't seem to think that kids can get this, but it's pretty clear that the trajectory of how it's affecting different age groups in the U.S. is very different than what's happening in other countries.
And even if they get it, and you know, they get it in comparatively very low numbers, but the transmission from one right. child to another child, now it's spread right. among like a number of different households yes. that are spreading yeah. it to each other. I mean, it makes apps. And meanwhile, here we have closed everything now. I mean, all the yeah. beaches, yeah. all the parks.
Playgrounds were early, actually.
Yeah. yeah. And they, I mean, so let's talk about what you wrote, Alyssa, because I've seen people saying, doctors saying in New York, don't go outside, don't take walks, like don't go on the sidewalk. It is not safe here to do that right now. You wrote, defying your personal brand, that it is, you have been trying to limit your family's own walk, like going out for strolls, essentially. Yeah. Talk about that.
Well, I think there were two things that have been pointed out repeatedly with the problems of going outside. And if you look at countries like Italy and Spain and parts of what France is going through right now, you cannot go outside in Italy and Spain right now. Like, you have to stay in your apartment. If you walk your dog, you get like some kind of special permission to do that. In Paris, you get like a permission slip that's good for an hour that says that you have to stay a certain distance close to your home. And I think that's how we need to start thinking about it, because the one thing that really, really caught my eye when I started to report this was San Mateo County, which is up north, very early also to shelter in place because they had some cases that were kind of an outbreak that was growing pretty quickly. Their public health officer was saying, not only should you really limit the amount of times that you're going outside, but you shouldn't even be traveling to a different neighborhood yeah. to go yeah. outside, because what you're doing is you're that kid on the playground, or, yeah. you know, you're the person who puts their hand on the, you know, car next to you or something. I don't know. Or coughs at someone as they go by. That's just creating this like chaotic spread of virus and around your city. And so you really have to think about being super, super local. And for us, you know, we're four people when we go out on the street. So we're four vectors, you know, of like, that's how I just think about it. We're like danger, we're trouble. And my kids don't really understand what's going on. We tried to explain it to them, but they don't understand why we're not going to Target or going to the playground, or why they're all closed, really. And, you know, there's just a lot of uncertainty about who we're going by on the sidewalk and stuff. So the sidewalks are too small. Sometimes we're going in the street. We're trying to get more in the street. I let my daughter ride her bike in the street a little bit. It was great. Like, no cars. It's all wonderful. But other people are not seeming to give the space. Or maybe you should walk in the street if you're a single person who is able-bodied and able to, you know, get in the street when there aren't any cars. But I'm just not seeing a lot of, even in like the most casual neighborhood walk, it's too much of a risk to me. And so even to like make the decision to go somewhere to exercise, I couldn't imagine even trying to go near a place, a destination, and you know, now most of those places are closed, but we're going to have people walking in their neighborhoods. And I've even seen people posting photos of their neighborhoods getting super crowded. And like, what do I do when I can't walk around? There's so many people walking around me. I think at least for the next two weeks, you really should try to limit going outside at all. And that's horrible for me to say. You're right. Very off-brand. Very, yeah. It like pains me very deeply to say this. But if you have a little outdoor space outside, look at some plants and play some music and jump around in your living room or something. But there's a whole equity side of it that it will need to be addressed at some point by the city. But I kind of agree, like right now, we all need to really stay put for at least 2 more weeks. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah. I mean, to what you're saying about the conditions on the streets and parts of LA, like places where I walk around, it is basically impossible for two people to pass each other at a distance of 6 feet. So you go out into the bike lane at best, but like probably into the street where cars are, like we talked about last week, still going really, really fast. Mm-hmm. And makes me wonder a little bit. There was an article from last week about how LA County doubled its ICU beds, but they basically filled up right away with non-COVID patients. Mm. And I was like, why could that possibly be happening? That's like so bizarre. But then you had read some stuff, Alyssa, indicating that there are, even though there are so many fewer cars on the road, there have been more injury crashes than than usual.
I mean, cars, when they see nothing around them, will go faster. And I actually drove the other day just to, you know, do an essential trip just to see what it was like, because I was like, I want to see. And it is true. Cars are going really fast with nobody on the road. And you can see on the freeway, especially where we can walk up and see like the 101, like the cars are just, there's never traffic. So people just take that as a sign to speed. So like I said, there's going to be something that's going to have to be done at some point from the city or county's perspective, because people won't be able to live like this for long and not get angry. You already saw people like jumping over the fences to get into Griffith Park. There's all these pictures of people, you know, which like, can't tell me what to do. The beaches being closed are very hard for the communities over there, which use it as, you know, also like transportation. Like there is like a bike path that's been closed too. And like that takes away the safe place to get up and down the coast if you need to get somewhere. So I think something will need to be done, and we really will need to think about how we're going to change our use of the streets. And there's some good examples, like New York closed like a few blocks in a few places, which also had like 13 cops per block to like enforce the closure, which seemed like we're getting in a whole other realm of problematic public space allocation. That's probably not the way to do it. But what I did hear something after I published the story about in Portland, they kind of came out and said every street is a shared street now, and everybody needs to think about how they're getting around, as you know, there will be people on bikes and on foot and on, you know, in strollers on every street. And I think that's an interesting way to think about it. But again, how do we instantaneously redesign LA to make it feel that way, that lets everybody know that they are safe getting around?
When most of our officials have baked into their careers that's not a possible change to make, right?
Of course.
I do think one thing that I feel like I feel like could have been done better about the response by the city to these shutdowns that we've seen sort of rolling throughout the city and county. I think we maybe talked about this last week, was right when they started saying, we're going to start closing down hiking trails and things like that. Immediately before that, the messaging had all been go outside, go hiking, but maintain social distancing. Yeah. And then public officials, including Mayor Garcetti, came back and said, you guys are hiking too much and we're going to close down all of the trails and everything. So I understand there are limited places for people to go in the city. We're a very park poor region, but I think that the messaging and sort of the like slow rolling closures of everything, which continued throughout this week, some of the trails were open, some were closed. Now they're all closed. Some of the beaches were open, I think, at the beginning of the week. Now they're all closed. I feel like if you want people to understand, it makes it easier to have like a simple message. And I feel like it's been very helter-skelter as certain things close, other things remain open, ostensibly all for the same rationale. So on Monday, you're saying we need to social distance. Trail A is closed, but trail B is open. And then by Thursday, you're saying we need to social distance. Everything is closed. I think it's just harder for people to understand the magnitude of what's going on. And I feel like that could have probably just been done from the start.
And with the parks closing and the beach closing, a lot of people live there. And just to update on like the effort to move people into shelters and to motels and hotels, the shelter numbers are, as I sort of alluded to last week, I think, way, way below what the city had promised, which was, I think, like in 4-digit numbers of people being able to move into 13 shelters, because they were talking about really packing people in and then realized, no, we actually need to give people a lot of room in these shelters when they're sleeping. And so And as well, I saw Councilmember Mike Bonin talking about how the state had promised to open up a lot of hotels and motels to for people to quarantine in and to live in. And that has not been happening with any level of speed whatsoever. I think they're talking about putting a small number of 25 or so RVs for quarantining on Dockweiler Beach and prioritizing the most vulnerable people. But I mean, the numbers right now are vanishingly small compared to the number of people that are still living outside and are vulnerable to this. Yeah. And Alyssa, you sent me a report this week from the National Coalition and Homelessness about how much more vulnerable people who are homeless are to COVID, primarily because of it's a predominantly older group. And there are often a lot of like comorbidities that they suffer that can make them that much more vulnerable. Just to wrap up the status report on coronavirus, I saw the University of Washington is putting up projections for when the outbreak will peak in different places. LA Times health reporter Soumya Karlamangla has been posting this, and I thought it was interesting. And it says that California, we don't have the numbers for LA County, but that California should peak on April 24th is what they are predicting. And that right now, because of early social distancing and all the other measures that the state has taken, we actually are not projected to exceed the number of needed hospital beds and to be right at the level about of what we have of ICU beds, which compared to, you look at those same numbers for places like New York, and it's a huge, huge difference. And so if that does turn out to be true, you wonder what kind of resources it's possible for us to share. I don't even know exactly how that would work.
I feel like this is a uniquely really, it's a really hard and horrible threat, particularly because, not only is the federal response essentially non-existent, but the real thrust behind this is to make all of the individual states act on their own, do what they can with the resources that they have in place. And it's so hard to know. You know, we've talked about the potential for there to be multiple peaks, right? To have a big first wave and then a secondary smaller wave. And it's so, I feel like it really breaks down a lot of, like, we could really easily compare or contrast this with the mentality that we have during something like fire season, where we have a really strong, within the state of California and throughout the Western states, we have a really strong mutual aid culture where firefighters go from one location to the next and there's a lot of sharing of resources. That is harder here because you don't know where or when those resources are going to be needed.
Okay. Should we talk about this city council meeting? So as much as I think Mayor Garcetti has demonstrated like really strong leadership and boldness, I think the city council has just as much sort of underperformed their duties when it comes to coronavirus, especially because it seems like people are mostly looking to the council to put financial protections in place, given the mass unemployment that we are already seeing in Los Angeles and will continue to see, and the threat of eviction and paying rent, which people will do on Wednesday. So the city council meeting, I do want to underscore that this almost didn't happen at all, this meeting, and in fact was fully canceled. So council president Nuri Martinez did take responsibility for this, but decided, I believe this had happened when we were recording last week, but decided to cancel all of the meetings for this past week and this coming week because of what was the initial explanation? Was it technical difficulties, Scott?
I think it was technical.
Yeah, the original reasoning was because they were not prepared to have remote meetings.
Right. But that explanation didn't really make sense given that they were canceling 2 weeks worth of meetings. It seems like maybe cancel the next one if you're not going to get it together in time, but also maybe leave open the option to meet later in the week or the following week, and which they eventually did do.
By this point in time, they had already canceled all of the committee meetings and they'd already canceled all of the Wednesday, Friday meetings. So there were only these two Tuesday meetings left in the month of March. And then they said, oh, well, Governor Newsom's shelter in place order means that we can't physically have this many people in council in the conference room, and we don't have a plan in place to do this kind of remote meeting. Then they kind of pivoted to saying that it was the IT department's fault that their streaming platform or whatever wasn't working appropriately.
And then also that they were trying to save the IT department's life because they would have to get together in some form in order to put this together. Meanwhile, Glendale had already set up, you know, it's Zoom. Like, it's not, as a lot of people pointed out, like, it's not super complicated. I mean, it's always a little, every time we try to start this podcast recording remotely, there's always like some weird problem, but like, you figure it out. And this meeting started off with basically every council member lining up, with the exception of Mike Bonin, to say that they were like aggrieved about getting yelled at for canceling the meeting, defending Nuri Martinez for canceling it, and said that she did the right thing, even though they did eventually undo that and hold the meeting on Friday. And Gil Cedillo had this quote about it.
Yes, there's a great sense of urgency, but we should distinguish urgency from hysteria. We are required to be thoughtful about how we move forward, including site and location, time, place, and manner. And so for those who think that all they have to do is raise the demand and wear a T-shirt and put a slogan together, that's not the way that we work through crises.
So yeah, shirts and slogans, he says, is not the right way to get things done, even though in this case it did get the meeting to happen.
Yeah,
we yelled about it and we're angry.
And just to say, like, so Gil Cedillo is, as far as I can tell, this was my immediate reaction as I was listening to this meeting on Friday, as far as I can tell, appears to be referring to the Healthy LA Coalition.
Yeah.
Which I originally said on Twitter is like over 100 groups signed on to this petition for how they think that the city council should respond to this crisis, including a blanket ban on evictions during the crisis and total forgiveness for rent that would be collected during this period, things that could really help out working class people in this county and city. And so you have Gil Cedillo saying that the public response has been akin to hysteria and saying that people are just like shouting slogans like Healthy LA or whatever because they don't understand how policymaking is really done is incredibly insulting. This from a man who, what, like 10 hours later would go on to cry about how he was up past his bedtime working on this legislation.
We all were. Maybe if you had had 2 meetings, it wouldn't have been that late.
That's, or even 3 meetings in 1 week. I mean, yeah. What? Like,
well,
like
the big argument that I think someone else said, I can't remember who, it's all a blur of like badly lit faces too close to the screen, but it, someone was like, oh, and just because we don't have a meeting doesn't mean we're not working.
Recording.
And I was like, ah, I don't know.
That was Paul Krikorian who said this quote. I mean, really just remarkable. He said, the public thinks that just because council is not meeting, that means the council isn't working. And in fact, it's quite the opposite, which is like just a truly remarkable thing to say as a council member.
And you gotta be live streaming your work all week in my mind. Like, just turn it on and be in front of your computer and let me see what you're doing. And if you're not going to have a meeting.
I mean, it would be one thing if the city council had not been operating under the presumption of widespread Brown Act violations for a decade. But to say, like, we're getting our real work done when the public isn't watching is maybe not the smartest thing to say.
Yeah, that's not what you're going to say as a your colleague, your ex-colleague is like signing a guilty plea. Right. Log on that day.
That's right. Oh, my God. We almost forgot that Mitch Englander, former council member, pled guilty to, I believe, the cover-up charges that the FBI brought against, that the federal government brought against him for stuff that we have talked about on this show many times, for accepting bribes to arrange a meeting for a cabinet salesman. That, I mean, that just said, I mean, like, for all the complaining that happened about this meeting, it was the best city council meeting probably ever, where there was a huge amount of open debate, which never happens. There was a divided council. Basically, wings have now formed of the city council, which we never really saw before. And it's been surprising in a lot of ways to see how they've shaken out. But between like the Zoom backgrounds and the technical difficulties. The beginning of the meeting, people instantly started posting dicks and like other like disgusting stuff on the Zoom feed, which like the most inevitable thing. And I know they knew was going to happen, but somehow didn't know how to mute other people.
That's public comment. It's okay.
You know, I do want to say about, so the vote that we were talking about first, where you were saying, hey, is that the individual council members, with the exception of Mike Bonin,
yeah,
were praising Nuri Martinez for her decision not to hold this meeting. The mood was extremely one of the public is judging us unfairly to such an extent that I would say that really what the council members were saying was the public does not have the right to judge us because they don't understand how this work should actually be done, which is, I mean, when we're talking about a circumstance like this, where we are, city council wants to say they're in uncharted waters here, that is at least as true and probably substantially more true for all of the people who live and work in this city. And city council has repeatedly just rejected the opportunity to be actual leaders of the people who live in Los Angeles. And it doesn't necessarily have to be this us versus them thing between city council and 4 million Angelenos, but that seems to be the path that they repeatedly have chosen to take. So, I mean, the vote itself was, since Nuri Martinez said that she was canceling all the meetings for the rest of the month, she actually didn't have the authority to do that. The city council has to recess, and they do that by a vote of the body. So Nuri Martinez had actually done something that the city council had to retroactively go back and make legal. And now they're recessed for an indefinite period of time. We don't know when the next meeting is actually going to be.
And this, despite all the rhetoric about like how urgent the situation was and how much they needed to like get together and make sure people were protected in this crisis, every single one of them except Mike Bonin voted to cancel next week's meeting and to not meet again at any specific time. So they're waiting basically on Nuri Martinez to decide when it's time for them to meet again. And I'll say, based on what happened in this meeting, you can see why, beyond technical reasons, they wanted to cancel it. There are a lot of council members that basically had their ass hanging out for not knowing enough about the crisis that was going on and not being willing to go on record as protecting people or not. They wanted to throw that responsibility to the mayor. And the mayor had put down an eviction moratorium that everyone on the council, like with a few exceptions, including Mike Bonin, basically wanted to say that that's the law of the land. Now, please, please don't make us vote on anything.
And Garcetti actually asked, there was a council member who had said that Garcetti was asking them, are there things that you want to do legislatively that I could do through executive order instead? Which was like just to add to your point about like this is not something that they wanted to engage in. They were really forced by the just complete outrage by the citizens of the city, the voters of the city, who were looking at this rightfully. In my view, I wrote another piece for our blog about this, mm-hmm, that this decision really just scans as like the political leadership of the city taking a vacation while everything is on fire. And they really got just completely roasted from all quarters, mm-hmm, for this decision, which is why they had to walk it back within the span of a week.
But they closed ranks on that too, for the most part. Mike Bonin was the only one after the meeting was canceled who was out there saying, I don't think this is the right decision. We have to meet as soon as possible.
Right. But yeah, let's talk about though, like this, one of the things that like you brought up, Hayes, like why they don't want to do this is because of this vulnerability. We'll talk more about the specific votes in a second, but what we've talked about in the past on this show, we have the statistic that you made extremely famous, that they vote unanimously 99.37% of the time. And we've talked at length about that, but this whole meeting was really an object lesson in the importance of that for individual city council members, because what they're doing is they're coming to an agreement in such a way that the public doesn't get to be part of these discussions, and we don't have the opportunity to actually hear their deliberations. So then when we start to, when we have an important vote come up, then we see it as 15-0 or 13-0 instead of getting to see who felt which way about which provision. So it really shuts the public out a lot from the process in a way that's unfair and very likely illegal. But what we had here today was exactly the opposite. We had a very public discussion, an extremely healthy democratic process. Like you said, Hayes, we have these wings that are suddenly very visible for the first time in any of these politicians' tenures. And there are going to be consequences for those votes and decisions the way that there should be.
I think there were probably more split votes in this council meeting than, I mean, more than the entire last year.
Yeah.
I mean, a really huge number. So let's talk about exactly what everybody voted on. First, this sort of got buried, but Hillside Villa, the building that we've talked about before on this show, but there it was under an affordability covenant saying that the entire building had to be affordable housing that was expiring after 30 years. And so all residents were about to see their rents jacked up unsustainably by the owner of the building, a guy named Tom Botts. And after a lot of pressure from activists in Chinatown and the LA Tenants Union, Councilmember Gil Cedillo did agree to put forward an eminent domain of this building, which for the city council is a huge move to basically buy this building from the owner and keep it affordable. And there was some hemming and hawing. There was a vote at this meeting over basically whether to move that proposal forward. And there was a little bit of second guessing about like a precedent, like what is this going to mean for future like building owners? But they did unanimously decide to move it along. So that was great. Then they got into a discussion of paid leave, which basically there were debates over how expansive to make paid leave policy in Los Angeles. The federal government has issued a number of tax credits for businesses under 500 employees to provide paid leave. And the council decided to expand paid leave for all local businesses with more than 500 employees. But there was some back and forth discussion over whether to do it for all businesses and whether or not it should be specific to coronavirus or not. There was some debate over that. Marquise Harris-Dawson, a council member, was the one who pointed out that it should also apply to undocumented employees, which the city attorney made sure that it did. That was he was the only person who brought that up, as far as I could tell.
Right, because the federal stimulus doesn't help anybody who is not a documented prisoner worker. Yeah.
And we still got a lot of the language that I think Scott brought up last week of this Hippocratic oath of most of all, we have to make sure that we don't harm businesses and landowners. Like, there's so much focus on that rather than tenants and workers.
I felt like a medical term was just completely inappropriate, basically, since we were talking about.
Well, somebody agreed with you. Okay. There was a public comment, by the way, in this session was top to bottom, like, excellent. Like, there's so many people were just really bringing the heat. And there was one comment that her name was a little difficult to hear. I think it was something like Chantilly Flossom or Slosson, but we'll play the whole clip here.
Next speaker, are you there?
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead and state your name, and then you have 1 minute to speak on item number 4.
Awesome. Thank you so much. My name is Chantilly Flossom, and I'm from District 1. Before I was laid off, my company did not provide sick leave. I had to sit in a meeting where a coworker begged us to wash our hands properly because he had no sick days available. He had to come to work and he had a husband at home battling cancer, and if he got COVID-19, his husband could die. Just 2 days later, my office closed because someone in my office had COVID-19 symptoms and was still waiting to get tested. My mother-in-law received a call from her work yesterday that her coworker had died from COVID. That coworker's husband is currently in the ICU right now, and her two children have just tested positive for the disease. People are dying. They died yesterday, they will die tomorrow, and you have the power now to save so many. And every day you delay, you're putting more lives at risk. You need to pass it today, and I would prefer you pass it as is. The Hippocratic Oath was written about human lives and not businesses and profit margins. You need to decide what is more important to you, which is business revenue or people's lives. Thank you.
So, yeah, saying that the Hippocratic Oath was about lives. It was about defending human life,
about
not profits.
Right.
And that was something that a lot of people on the council really needed to hear, because they kept saying over and over again, we have to make sure that too much pressure isn't placed on businesses, instead of saying, like, that pressure always falls down onto workers and tenants who are less equipped to deal with it. And this came up with the eviction moratorium as well. You can, like, it's safer to make a landowner or a business owner go through bureaucratic hurdles to, like, to get, like, the benefits they need, to get, like, things from the government, to get exemptions, whatever it is. That's part of the job of owning a business, of owning a building. But if you're a worker or a tenant, you don't have the tools to necessarily navigate those processes. But over and over again, the pressure is being put on workers and tenants instead right. of business owners and landlords.
Yes. And I think this is like a huge problem with the federal response to this, too, because, you know, we heard all these ridiculous arguments this week about like, oh, it should, isn't the response to shutting down the economy worse than letting a whole bunch of people die? You know, I mean, really just this capitalism has broken your brain and you need to like just take a step back and think about what you're arguing for. If you actually think that getting everybody back to work as soon as possible is going to fix this in any way, because what we need to be doing and what countries like, I think Denmark is doing this and the Netherlands, they're really just saying we're giving everybody like a 2-week vacation and we'll cover it from the top to the bottom and we'll cover it and we will pay you. Mm-hmm. You have to stay home. More people have to stay home. You shouldn't be going to work because you have to pay rent. You shouldn't be going to work because you want your business to somehow survive this. We are making sure that we're like putting a pause on the economy. And when you come back, we'll still be here and everybody will be alive and we can continue on with our lives. And the federal government obviously has not chosen that approach. They're just going to mail. If you got a check here in LA, you're one of the people who get a check that won't even cover your rent, won't even cover the median rent for the city of LA. Right. So we have to provide that feeling for the people who live and work here. So we don't have, that will make our outbreak worse if people yeah. are going to work sick or if they're making their employees stay to run a business that is, you know, essential, but not maybe completely essential at this time. So you have to really think about what we can do as a city. And if we don't do that, more people are going to die.
And the economy, I mean, like, even if
and the economy will also die.
Yeah.
Yes. Like, and the economy will die.
And that applies to almost every decision that they're making here. And Mike Bonin alluded to this later. When it comes to keeping people housed, that is not a problem that just goes away if you say, like, okay, right. like, you know, you give them a weaker eviction moratorium that they have to navigate. That means more people become homeless. And now they are a much bigger problem for the city government, much more costly, much more work is going to be involved to get them back into housing than just keeping them in their homes initially. It's not the fiscally responsible decision, and it's not the one that saves them the most work. It's just in the short term, easier for them to do less, but they will end up paying for it later. Let's talk about the eviction moratorium. This was something they debated for, I think, a couple hours. This was a really involved conversation. Pretty much everyone waited except I think Curran Price, who only spoke once, maybe twice for the entire meeting.
And there were a few 12 hours long. Once in 12 hours.
There were a few moments that were very funny, which where Nuri Martinez was the only one in the actual City Hall chambers. And she would say, Mr. Price, you wanted to say something? Mr. Price? Mr. Price?
He must have been asleep.
Yeah.
A few of them must have taken a few naps.
Which Gil Cedillo openly said that
he took a nap. Yeah. But the whole music is very relaxing.
But it's also, it's daytime. It was daytime the whole time. You know, this didn't go till like, it was done by like 10:30 or something, right?
Every time the recess music went on, I would like envision all of them like taking out their earbuds and being like, oh, what a day. What a day. Walking around the house. Doing shots. Like, I don't know. It's just
So basically what happened is the last time they met, Mike Bonin put forward an eviction moratorium that would basically say you can't be evicted during the emergency period for non-payment of rent. I believe he was pushing it to be you can't be evicted for any reason.
Correct.
And it was watered down to say you can't be evicted for non-payment of rent and you have to pay back the missed rent over the course of Bonin had pushed for 2 years, 24 months, and that was reduced to 6 months.
Yep.
Meaning that once you start resuming paying your rent again, you have to start paying back your missed rent and fully pay back whatever you missed over the course of 6 months, no matter how much rent you missed.
Yeah. Yep.
That there was a lot of debate in the ensuing week, people saying that 6 months was way too short. And they came back to discuss increasing it to, I believe Herb Wesson put forward increasing it to 12 months. You would have 12 months to pay back that missed rent. And Joe Buscaino, council member of the 15th district, came through with this quote about it.
The issue that Mr. Wesson raised, I believe when last time we met on the floor, we agreed to go 6 months. And I'm just kind of scratching my head. Why are we revisiting this to extend to 12 months? And here's why. I believe, you know, we have to do all we can to ensure that property owners don't go into default in light of this COVID-19 crisis. So my question is, Sharon So still on the floor there. Would it be possible for us to, Sharon, to reassess this ordinance at 6 months to see if we need to continue it?
Council member, you always have that ability to reassess an ordinance. You don't have to wait for 6 months. In fact, that's what Mr. Michelson was saying, that any additional changes that were discussed that require additional legal analysis and review by the city attorney's office could actually be brought forward far earlier than the 6 months that you just mentioned.
God help us if this virus or this pandemic.
So he's scratching his head. The point at the end is so revealing, where he says, God forbid in 6 months we're still going through this crisis. That demonstrates a total lack of understanding of what is being discussed. The eviction yeah. moratorium and the payback period is not for while the crisis is happening. It is for the aftermath. So to say, like, 6 months from now, we're not going to still have a virus, why would people need 6 months to pay back this rent? Dude, what do you know? Like, this discussion, your involvement in this is extremely impactful. Do you not know
what's happening?
About?
Yeah, no, and that was one of a number of revealing comments to that effect, where it just seemed like people didn't have a good grasp of, like, what was urgent and why. We're also talking about, during this meeting, rehiring people who are laid off and giving people the right to be recalled from unemployment. That was eventually tabled because council members, including Buscaino and Paul Krikorian, we're like, well, nobody's going to be rehiring before next week, so why don't we just table this and not even discuss it for now?
Meanwhile, there's like job, all the grocery stores need, I mean, there's so many jobs like that people are demanding workers for immediately locally.
And Mike Bonin correctly pointed out, people are terrified. Like, give them some indication over whether they will be able to go back to the job that they just had.
What we talked about last time, if they could actually get everyone housed in motels and hotels, you'd be able to bring back service workers who would be able to work hopefully safely in safe situations. But you could say, we need to feed, house, care for all these people, and we can do it in hotels, and that would be another great job, you know, if people really wanted to work or were able to work.
But I want to address Buscaino's like chief point of confusion, like, as to why the length of the repayment was being revisited. So he was one of the council members in the previous meeting who had worked to get Bonin's original 2-year period cut back down to 6 months. All of the council members were saying, again, this was where our first do no harm to landlords canard was introduced by Krikorian. The goal was to tamper as little as possible with the landlord tenant relationship that is represented by the rental agreement or the lease. So they wanted to make it as short a period of time as possible because they were afraid that renters were going to take advantage of this and landlords needed to be able to recoup whatever money they should have been earning during this period. But then in the intervening week, what happened was every city council member got completely just railroaded by their constituents over the decision to cut this back to such a short period of time. That was why they were revisiting it. So Joe Buscaino is like saying, I don't even know why we're talking about this, is very also revealing of just the fact that he doesn't care how frightened all of these Angelenos are or what the comments that himself and all of his colleagues have been receiving about this motion were.
And he followed up directly after this quote. He said something else, which I think was one of the things that resonated the most with the people following this meeting. And let's play that clip from Joe Buscaino.
Secondly, I also struggle with Mr. Bonin's amendments. And I share and echo the same comments that Mr. Lee made with indeed if there is an illegal activity happening with a specific tenant or in the unit. I can tell you I've experienced that as a patrol officer in the city. There's a loud party, if there's illegal prostitution, if there's prostitution going on in a unit, if there's illegal drug activity in a unit, are they going to be exempt from the amendment?
So he talks about how you can't just impose a moratorium where you can't evict anyone for any reason because of loud parties, which are currently illegal, by the way.
Already illegal, yeah. Yes. I think
prostitution, also illegal, as he points out, and drug use, and how in those situations, landlords have to be able to evict someone during a pandemic, which will make them, by definition, homeless. As Mike Bonin pointed out elsewhere in the discussion, there is no way to obey the law and to get into new housing once you have been evicted during this pandemic. But Mike Bonin responded. I mean, he really was the closest thing we have to a hero at this city during like pretty much the whole meeting. He's got his newsy cap on. He looks like he's at the Departed, and he responded pretty much directly to what Joe Buscaino was saying with this clip.
A couple quick points. One, I want to note that there's been a tendency in some of our conversations to assume the best intentions of anybody who's a landowner and to assume, for purposes of argument, the worst intentions of tenants. I also think it's important to note that while the courts may be closed, the practical impact of this is residents not knowing that they do not have an actual eviction moratorium in place. Some of them will be intimidated out by their landlords. Some of them will be negotiated out by their landlords. And some of them literally will be locked out by their landlords. And the final thing I would say in closing is the best thing to do in a circumstance like this, in an emergency, is to do something simple. We can always revise this later. The simplest thing is to have a moratorium in effect so people do not wind up out on the street. Because doing anything other than simple is asking people to jump through hoops, to scale hurdles, and go through an administrative process. And that is something that really only feels like a moratorium to people inside of government. And that is not, in real world, going to be a moratorium for actual tenants who will otherwise wind up out on the streets, and then we'll be dealing with those consequences. Thank you.
So that was so perceptive, and I saw so many people quoting it. This idea was so true that everyone else on the council seemingly was assuming the worst of tenants and the best of landlords, when in fact the opposite is often true. He's exactly right that landlord, you give a loophole and they will use it to get rid of tenants if they want someone to replace them who will pay more. They won't let this crisis go to waste. And he alludes to at the end, he says, people will be out of the street, at which point they will be a bigger problem for us. That's something that I want to underscore again. This isn't the fiscally responsible decision. It's not the easier decision. Like it is just kicking the can down the road and giving the city and our city government like way more problems to deal with going forward. But unfortunately, that the strengthened eviction moratorium failed. Basically, the all-encompassing eviction ban failed.
And not only was Bonin having to fight against his colleagues to build support for this, he was also having to fight against a representative from the city attorney's office who was, I mean, I'm not super concerned with like a lot of the substance of what he was saying, other than the fact that a big part of his argument, the representative David Michelson from the city attorney's office, was based on what seems to be a totally incorrect reading of the executive order that had at that point in time just been issued by Gavin Newsom, which encouraged explicitly local governments to go further than that. And the city attorney's office
wanted to. Yeah. Gavin Newsom passed an eviction moratorium that is not very strong, not binding, and forces tenants to prove that they are under financial duress because of the pandemic, which landlords are already saying. I've seen online, people have texted me forms that their landlords are making them fill out saying, give me a letter from your boss saying that you've been laid off because of coronavirus, or like, so show me your bank statement, like show me that you can't pay this rent. And Like whether, and, you know, in some cases, like, let's talk about protecting street vendors. Like, where's the documentation showing that?
Yeah, I mean, where's your letter from your boss? Right.
Yeah, I mean,
where's
you show them the letter from the city that their work is now forbidden. But like this, putting all this pressure on tenants makes it so easy for landlords to take advantage of them. But exactly like you're saying, the governor said cities can and should go farther if they want to. And the assistant city attorney or whatever David Michelson is incorrectly said that what they were talking about with the more expansive ban was not allowed. It was totally allowed.
Yeah.
And then, it was explicitly allowed.
And then the subsequent argument was, we have this draft ordinance that we wrote according to what you asked us to write last time. And now you want us to go back and write a different ordinance? Well, like that would be like an entirely separate thing. And Mike Bonin, to his credit, never wavered during this entire discussion. He was saying, the ordinance I want you to write is much more simple than what we currently have in front of us. All I want is to say no evictions can be filed during the time period, you know, whatever the time period is. It's that simple. Unfortunately, at the end of all of that discussion, it ended up not being enough to convince a majority of the council members. Hayes, do you want to talk about the vote itself?
Yeah. So there were 15 council members present. Two members recused themselves, Paul Krikorian and Curran Price. And later they said that they recused themselves because they are landlords in the city of Los Angeles, which a lot of activist groups had criticized them and five, six other members of the city council for being landlords and said that they should recuse themselves in these situations. So the two of them did recuse themselves from this vote for that reason. And then so the vote that was taken was between was among the remaining 13 council members, and seven people voted yes, six council members voted no. And so you would think that the yes would win, but in fact they lost because they still needed eight yes votes because the other two council members were just recusing themselves. What? They weren't present. They were present. So it was incredibly complicated and stupid. It basically means that if you recuse yourself, it's the same as voting no. I saw some people texting me saying, like, well, this really backfired on the leftists because Curran Price probably would have voted yes.
I doubt it.
Which is like, well, he did. He voted no for all intents and purposes by just the nature of the situation. But there was some confusion over whether it was even like resolved correctly. It was a total mess.
Yeah. And actually, to further the point that you're making, the rule 25 that was actually posted by Michael Kohlhaas, who was actually the person who found all of the landlords on the council.
Yeah,
it actually is not the number of members present. It is a majority of the entire membership of the council, regardless of how many of them are present. So you need eight votes no matter what.
Okay.
Yeah. So but I'm very skeptical that if Price had voted that he would have voted in favor of the full eviction moratorium. I just don't believe it, frankly.
It's very difficult to read into his thoughts, but he never speaks ever. I mean, has like two legs out the door, like serving out the rest of his term. But so let's talk about like the way the vote broke down. And this is sort of the wings that are forming. The no votes were Bob Blumenfield in the 3rd District, who said that he didn't think an eviction moratorium was necessary because the courts are closed, which is like, okay, then just do it.
Right.
Like, the landlords are still going to evict their tenants. They are going to issue evictions and say, I dare you to take us to, what, you have a lawyer? Like, try and take us to court for this. Paul Krikorian, I think we can assume, based on previous statements, would have voted a no had he not recused himself.
Yep.
But the no votes were Bob Blumenfield, Nuri Martinez, council president, Monica Rodriguez, who said lots of like completely bizarre stuff about being worried that private equity would come in and buy up people's single family homes because the landowners couldn't get the money from renters and so would have to sell to private equity. So now like that falls on the tenants instead. It was like incredibly confusing. John Lee, of course, the one Republican on the council in CD 12, Mitch O'Farrell in CD 13, who does not want to be council member anymore. He is begging to be voted out of office. As you point out many times, Scott, he lives in the most progressive district by far, and he is now like firmly camped out in the right wing of the city council for no political or any other reason that I can divine.
It's total political incompetence, as far as I can tell. This does not seem like it was a calculated decision. It seems like he voted, with the presumption that nobody would be paying enough attention to know, and came on Twitter yesterday and today, seemingly with the expectation that people would regard him as having done something heroic, and not that he would be viewed as a villain who was obviously on track to lose his seat when his term ends in 2022.
And Joe Buscaina was the sixth no vote.
And let's also mention that with everything else that's been passed this week and discussed, people who own property, people who have mortgages are all very well taken care of through this whole crisis. Mm-hmm. And
by the state
really,
and federal
by the state
government.
And at the federal level. And so there's been some comments about we want to protect people who own the properties, but they're all taken care of. Like, and you see even places like the Cheesecake Factory, which is doing a rent strike because they are saying, at the corporate level, we have small and large businesses saying we are not paying our rent. We're going to have a mass rent strike happening here because the protection is coming from the top down and not from the bottom up. So I think we'll see not just the Cheesecake Factory, but many other organized groups, because it's not a secret that the property owners are taken care of and won't have to pay. So why should we?
Yeah, I mean, that was we saw before we get into the yes votes on this, we also saw a variety of council members during the course of this meeting engage in some serious goalpost moving with respect to what it would take for them to consider property owners as having been protected. Going from with the mortgage forgiveness that is largely in place for landowners, then John Lee and I believe also Monica Rodriguez made a couple references to, oh, well, it's not just mortgages. It's also mortgage insurance and property taxes and utility bills, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, okay, well, it is clear to everybody paying attention that you just do not think that renters should get these benefits, and you do think that landlords should get whatever benefits they can.
So the yes votes, the remaining council members on the eviction moratorium that have now kind of coalesced in sort of a progressive wing of the council were Mike Bonin, who brought the eviction ban forward, David Rue. We got sort of an early glimpse at how David Rue will be running in the general election against Nithya Raman, which was made official this past week. Which is essentially trying to become her, it appears. it's one of the strongest endorsements of Nithya's campaign is how much David Rue seems to want to do it now, including putting forward a freeze on rent increases, which Nithya has campaigned on for about a year now, even though this would be a freeze on rent increases during the pandemic, during the emergency period, which will save, if it does happen, will save tenants a comparatively negligible amount of money. And Nithya has been running on something much more expansive. But he voted yes. Marquise Harris Dawson, Herb Wesson, Paul Koretz, and is that it? Oh, and Gil Cedillo.
After he woke up.
Yeah. So those were the seven yes votes. But I mean, it was pretty early in Nuri Martinez's tenure. A big split has formed, and it's weird to see. But for people who follow city council, I think it was nice to have these divisions kind of brought into the open instead of just wondering how they went behind the scenes.
Like actually being able to see people's faces and see the emotion and hear what they're, sometimes it's very hard to hear what they're saying and when they're in council chambers. So maybe that for the next few months, at least for however long we have to do this, this will create some much needed empathy and maybe knowing that people are watching you, you might decide that you want to do the right thing.
Yeah. Alyssa had a great thread ranking everyone's Zoom background on her Twitter account. And I think each one kind of shows their personalities in a different way.
Or lack of.
I was that was fun. that's about all we have time for this week. Something to look at for Tuesday's county supervisor meeting, which I believe is also happening via, it is happening via teleconference, and people have to submit comment a day in advance. There is the power struggle between the Board of Supervisors and the sheriff continues, basically with the Board of Supervisors wanting to remove the sheriff's emergency powers during the pandemic. Is that right, Alyssa?
It's so that's been, well, first of all, there was two things with our old friend Villanueva. First of all, he said he was going to shut down gun shops.
Yeah.
And as a non-essential business, and that didn't go over very well with the NRA and various Second Amendment groups. So I think there's a lawsuit being introduced at the state level by people who think that gun shops are essential. You saw these lines of people. I think there's one in Culver City. Mm-hmm. That was, the photo was shared nationally. But now our lovely county supervisor are trying to strip him of some of his powers at this time.
To talk about, I mean, never, not letting a crisis go to waste.
Go to waste. So what does that entail, actually? Like, what are his, does he have it enhanced powers right now? Because we are in like the county crisis mode, right? So yes. What does this mean?
I believe he does have enhanced powers that on Tuesday, the supervisors will potentially vote to take away. And whether it's all of them or specific powers, I'm sure a lot of them will be, I mean, they're emboldened by the passing of Measure R, which allows them to regulate the sheriff's department more directly. So I think we'll hear more. This was like reporting done in advance of the meeting that this was something that the supervisors were going to try to right. do.
So tune in.
This is something where the sheriff, because of the state of emergency, I think that the contention of the Board of Supervisors is dating back to a point in time where LA County was significantly smaller than it is now. The sheriff in a state of emergency is viewed as the person who would logically be leading up some of the administrative effort of coordinating an emergency response. Although the sheriff has contended that it is directly retaliatory for the decision to close the gun shops down. But he's been doing other things as well, like recommending people for release from pretrial jail terms, things like that, which need to happen. Like that's definitely something that, regardless of who's doing it, still needs to take place.
But do I want him making those decisions?
Yeah, is this the person in this time of crisis?
No, I mean, obviously, but it's actually like the worst of both worlds, because we are relying on Sheriff Villanueva to make a recommendation for release, and then Jackie Lacey, district attorney for the county, her office gets final say on whether or not they're going to like proceed with charges.
Seems
on
like a good so, team in this.
No, I don't want either of those people making those decisions.
So while we were recording, we did get the newest daily update on the number of new cases and deaths in LA County. 332 new cases and 5 new deaths, which I believe is the same number of deaths as yesterday. The number of new cases is just so noisy at this point when you don't know how many new tests have been happening. We had a huge increase earlier this week that corresponded with a lot of new testing being done. So that number is not of a huge significance, although that number of new cases is basically the number of new cases we've seen over the past 3-ish days. And they also report that 453 people have been hospitalized in LA County over the course of the pandemic, and presumably some number have been released. So obviously, 5 deaths is tragic, but that number keeps us on the relatively slow pace. It doesn't demonstrate the increase that I think we are like eventually anticipating and scared about. But over the last 4 or 5 days, I think the number of deaths has ranged from 5 to 9. So all kind
per
of
day.
Yeah, per day.
Yeah.
So kind of all in that same area. We also want to talk about the case that made national news this week of a teenager in Lancaster who the county public health department announced had died of COVID, was the first person under 18 in, I think, California, at least in LA County.
In the U.S., I think.
In the U.S.
In the U.S.
To die of coronavirus. Then they came out and said that the case was complex and they were removing it from the numbers of people who had officially died of coronavirus. Then the mayor of Lancaster, Rex Paris, came out and started talking about it and said that the teenager had been refused service at urgent care because he didn't have health insurance. The case is horrible regardless. Again, Rex Paris is not necessarily the person I want like out in front of this talking about it. But we were texting this week about it, but basically saying it would have sort of been better to withhold all information about this until we know exactly what happened, to put it out there and then to say, oh, well, maybe it wasn't this. We have to do more investigation. Like, it, I don't know. It just kind of makes it difficult.
Maybe it'd just be accurate to say our healthcare system killed someone, and maybe the illness maybe contributed slightly to that, but that may be more accurate.
That does appear to be what happened. But, you know, in these cases, you want the family to...
Right.
Like, agree to this story being out there before it is to the degree that it already is, where a lot of people are guessing and going off the word of people that don't necessarily know exactly what happened. So I'm sure we will hear more about that in the coming weeks. So maybe we can do an update on that next week. Thank you for listening. Everyone, please stay safe at home. Thank you, Brian Holmes, the producer of this podcast. We will be back next week on LA Podcast. Bye. Yeah!